You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show with me, Hannah, and Edmi this morning.
Morning, everyone. How are you going? I'm very good. I've had a very busy weekend, but we're here. We're ready to go.
Yeah, what'd you do?
Yesterday I went to Camp Sovereignty and sat by the sacred fire and took a moment to actually just pause and reflect. Was lucky enough to do some cleansing. Uncle Robbie Thorpe was there. Also went to the rally, which was good. Yeah, and did some support work. How about you?
I have my birthday.
Hey.
Sung a lot of karaoke. It was really fun.
Fun. That's so fun. Karaoke's good fun. It is. At a party, it lifts the spirits.
Everyone got so into it. It was great.
It was amazing. It's nice to have you back on the show. This is the first show we're back on together for the first, like, probably 6 weeks.
Yay.
So to all those listening, in your car, give a little click and welcome back, Hannah.
It's a reunion.
Yay.
It's the reunion tour. Okay, so... on the show today, we have a pretty exciting show. Up first, we've got an interview that Rob did with Ari Bezaroglu from, he's the Director of Legal Services from Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, talking about the proposed bail law amendments in Victoria. And then secondly, we have human rights activist Robert Martin from yesterday's Palestine rally. He was speaking about his recent experience on the Freedom Flotilla. And then third, do you want to talk about the interview that you did?
Yeah, sure. Up next. Well, sorry, not up next, but third. I spoke with a friend and local artist of Cambodian descent named Sentosa about her experience of I suppose living in Melbourne and exploring her diaspora through art and artistic expression, working in the sex industry and being challenged with and facing and navigating her identity through discrimination, sexism, racism and living here in Australia.
Cool. And then lastly, we have Professor Damien Kingsbury speaking with Jan Bartlett from 3CR's Tuesday Home Time last week about the reasons behind the ongoing conflict between Cambodia and Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
But should we do the headlines first?
Let's get into the nitty gritty.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or right down to the real nitty-gritty.
You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Monday, the 18th of August, 2025. The Centre Against... listeners, please note that the following headline contains the names of people who have died. If the headline causes you distress, please call 13YARN at 139276, 24/7 crisis support for First Nations people of this continent. Alternatively, folks can call Lifeline at 13 11 14. The Centre Against Racial Profiling have released a statement regarding the continued privatisation of security by the City of Melbourne and other local councils, adopting the Private Security Melbourne model and use of what is known as the Thin Blue Line. A six-month trial will be conducted contracting private security to target begging, alcohol consumption and antisocial behaviour in the CBD and areas such as Footscray and Maribyrnong. The Thin Blue Line is a controversial patch being worn on the uniforms of security guards and formerly by the police force. The Thin Blue Line is seen as controversial due to its co-option as a racist symbol by white supremacist and far-right groups and as a reactionary symbol against the Black Lives Matter movement. With police in Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland banning the patch from their uniforms, the ABC released a report on the 13th of August outlining the sensitivity of the symbol as, quote, "The symbols and concept have been negatively associated with a them and us approach to policing, use of excessive force, and support for racism," end quote. Despite this, there have been widespread community reports of police in Melbourne wearing the Thin Blue Line on their uniforms, including at protests. The Centre Against Racial Profiling have brought attention to the use of the Thin Blue Line as, quote, "The privatisation of public safety is a concerning trend that opens the door to the expansion of racialised profiling. Local councils are outsourcing the management of complex social issues like homelessness and poverty to private security firms, whose employees display symbols associated with racism and far-right extremism," end quote. Sergeant Lee Bowens, the Northern Territory police officer and direct supervisor of former police constable Zachary Rolfe, who fatally shot 19-year-old First Nations man Kumanjayi Walker in 2019, had publicly displayed a Facebook image wearing the Thin Blue Line for 3 years, triggering an inquest and subsequent ban of the Thin Blue Line in the police force. Further, the recent police shooting of Somali man Abdifatah Ahmed in Footscray in April of this year remains fresh in the memory of community members, and with private security co-opting the Thin Blue Line in their uniforms and set to patrol these same areas, racial tensions have the potential to be flared. If this headline causes you distress, please call 13YARN at 139276 or Lifeline at 13 11 14.
Also in news, since late 2024, there's been an algal apocalypse in South Australia, severely killing all levels of marine life. The harmful algal bloom has been devastating South Australia's marine environment, killing thousands of fish, sharks, rays and invertebrates. The toxic algae bloom turned reefs and seagrass beds into lifeless zones. A fisher from Marion Bay, Romeo Lubicic, said, quote, "We're seeing places that used to be full of fish completely empty," end quote. "Cuttlefish were washing up in the thousands," end quote. Nutrient runoff, prolonged heat waves, and calm seas created the conditions for the bloom to spread. It's stretched across Gulf St. Vincent, Kangaroo Island, and even further. Satellite data shows high chlorophyll levels, or red zones, matching areas of mass marine deaths. Local fishers and divers have reported unusual fish behavior, mass mortalities, and dead zones extending down to 30 metres. These beach wash-ups only show a fraction of what's happening beneath the surface. Marine ecologist Janine Baker said, quote, "The real impact is hidden on the seafloor," end quote. Over 5,000 mortality reports have been logged by citizen scientists, and experts warn that the long-term damage could reshape South Australia's marine ecosystems for years.
Also in news this week, in the early hours of this morning, at least 57 Palestinians across the Gaza Strip have been killed, with at least 37 killed while seeking aid. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 11 more have died from starvation in the last 24 hours, taking the known toll from starvation to 251, including 108 children. In an article published by Al Jazeera, rallies in Tel Aviv, Israel, have seen hundreds of thousands of Israelis calling on their government to end the war and for Hamas to return all captives, while protests continue globally after the killing of Al Jazeera's journalists. Palestinians in the West Bank's Ramallah have rallied together to protest, quote, Israeli attacks and starvation on Gaza, while also holding banners commemorating Al Jazeera's assassinated journalists and longtime prisoner Marwan Barghouti, end quote. These have been the news headlines for Monday the 18th of August, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're ready to make a difference? My name is Nasser Mashni. I host Palestine Remembered each Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. It's Australia's only dedicated radio show on Palestine. 3CR Community Radio is more than just a station. It's a platform for voices you won't hear anywhere else. And we need you. 3CR is an outlet that gives a voice to the voiceless. For nearly five decades, 3CR has amplified the struggles, stories, and successes of marginalised and silenced communities. From First Nation voices to workers' rights and grassroots campaigns to global solidarity, this is where justice speaks. When you subscribe to 3CR, you're not just tuning in, you're taking a stand. You're supporting independent media that fights for truth, diversity, and equality. 3CR is powered by people like you. No ads, no corporate control, just raw, real radio created by the community for the community. So what are you waiting for? Show your solidarity today. Subscribe to 3CR and help us keep the airways free for voices that matter.
3CR. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM, tuned into the Monday Breakfast Show with Ed, me, myself and Hannah. To start us off today, we'll be listening to an interview that Rob has pre-recorded for us with Ali Bezaroglu. Ari is the Director of Legal Services at the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, and the interview is about proposed bail law amendments in Victoria. Please note that the next 15-minute segment contains the names of Indigenous people who have died in custody. If this segment causes you distress, First Nations listeners can call 13 Yarn 139276, which is a 24/7 crisis support for First Nations people. Alternatively, folks can call Lifeline at 13 11 14. At the end of July, the Victorian government proposed a second set of bail amendments, furthering its ambition to have the strictest bail laws in this continent. Similar to the first set of bail amendments introduced to Victorian Parliament in March, the Allan government is claiming the legislation will, quote, prevent re-offending and keep the community safe, end quote. To help us unpack the potentially disastrous consequences of this legislation, the Monday Breakfast Show is now joined by Ali Bezaroglu. Ali is the Director of Legal Services at the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. He worked at Vowles for 7 years in criminal and civil law before moving to Robinson Gill, where he practiced in civil litigation against the state of Victoria. Ali has represented many First Nations families in coronial inquests into deaths in custody, including Auntie Donna for the coronial inquest into the passing of her daughter, Veronica Nelson.
Thank you so much, Ali, for joining us on the show. I heard your speech at the Bail Saves Lives SNAP rally a few weeks ago, which, if listeners want to go back to listen to it, the Do and Time show had it not last week, but the week before on their show. Maybe you just want to explain to listeners what exactly this new set of bail reforms entails.
Yeah, thanks, Rob, and thanks for having me. So really, the new bail reform laws that we're seeing have been brought in two stages. So we saw Tranche 1 come into effect at the end of March, where there were a number of changes, but most notably, remand is no longer a tool of last resort for children, which is what it was previous to that. And importantly, the Parliament reintroduced the offence of committing an indictable offence whilst on bail, which was basically rolling back of bail reforms made after the inquest into the passing of Veronica Nelson. It's important to note that after Tranche 1, we've seen at Vals a 300% increase in remand with respect to youth. And that's before Tranche 2 has come into effect. And we're now talking about Tranche 2 amendments, and those proposed before the Parliament at the moment, which are yet to be resolved. Firstly, they've elevated a number of stricter bail tests for certain serious offences, armed robbery, aggravated burglary, home invasion, carjacking, and then elevated a number of other offences to, let's say, a mid-level of bail test. And I think the one that's probably most controversial is this. Previously, it was called the double uplift, whereas if you're committing an offence whilst on bail, you would continue to go up the chain of tests where the test of getting your liberty would be tougher. But in this case, they've called it a two-strike test. Basically, if you commit an offence or if you commit... if you commit an indictable offence whilst on bail, you'll be uplifted to a higher test of compelling reasons. Now, the government sort of, our key criticism was that really Veronica at the time, this catch-all provision captured poverty offences, and all of a sudden we started to see, you know, people who were disenfranchised within the community for petty offending being put on the strictest test of bail. So in this proposal, the government has tried to do a carve-out. So theft, for example, for up to $2,500 isn't included in this uplift provision. But we still think, given the state of the current system insofar as statistics are concerned and the amount of people that are in custody since the first round of reforms, we think it's a disaster waiting to happen with the introduction of Tranche 2.
Do you think that this these reforms, especially with combined with the reforms introduced into law earlier this year in March that you mentioned, do you think that they would exacerbate the sort of conditions that led to the avoidable death in custody of Veronica Nelson?
Absolutely. We've seen this. We're seeing the swelling of prison numbers right now. Prisons haven't been able to cope with the amount of demand at the moment. The prison response to the swelling numbers has been locking people down in cells because of staffing shortages, and that's directly due to the explosion of remand numbers. What do we know about overcrowding in prisons? We know that it strains health, it strains mental health, and cultural support services. In the Nelson inquest, the coroner referred to that state at the time, or the bail laws at the time, as a complete and unmitigated disaster. And it's unfortunate that we've turned right back to it. And I should mention, in New South Wales, since tougher bail laws were introduced in June of 2023, there's been now, which was reported last week, record number of First Nations remand numbers. Aboriginal children now make up in their prisons 60% of all children in New South Wales prisons. As for the adults, they make up 33% of the prison population. That is a harrowingly shameful statistic. And especially when you consider that the New South Wales population of First Nations people is 3%, it is a gross overrepresentation. And we've seen this play out. The Victorian government has not only seen that play out, but is boasting about our bail laws being tougher than what New South Wales is. So So it's like watching a train wreck in slow motion, and, you know, we're all strapped in for the ride.
Obviously, you know, being worse than New South Wales, having, you know, bail reform that's worse than New South Wales, is very scary. Do you think that these amendments will keep everyone in the community safe, as the Victorian government is sort of using that excuse as a, you know, a guise to introduce this legislation?
Yeah. Do I think? Absolutely not. There is countless research, empirical evidence. What we know about institutionalization is that it's criminogenic. The more you lock up, the more likely people will reoffend. That's the nature of institutionalization. And that is especially true for children. Locking up as a first resort disrupts, what we know is it disrupts family connections, cultural connections, severs community ties, cultural ties, country ties, employment connections, housing connections, and ultimately increases psychological harm. And, you know, this isn't a new concept. The Supreme Court has previously recognised that the granting of bail, for example, to a child, although it may be, they may present, let's say, a short-term risk, but it's actually a better mechanism to address crime than sending a child to prison. So I've got here a quote from a 2019 decision, and this is by Justice Reardon in a case. And his Honour said this: although the grant of bail may expose the community to some short-term risks that the applicant will reoffend while on bail, the incarceration of this young man on remand for a further period of 12 months is most unlikely to reduce the risk of reoffending when he is ultimately released, and may have the opposite effect. A grant of bail, as compared to a remand for up to 12 months, will enable the applicant to receive intensive family support and treatment in the community. This may maximise his chance of rehabilitation and minimise the long-term risk to the community of future offending. So, again, it's nonsensical that we say that the community is protected by sending people to jail. It's directly contradictory. You can't promote community safety through prison. It's like, watering weeds and then watching them grow out of proportion. It turns into a perpetual cycle while prison warehousing numbers just continue to grow. And then what we see with the growth of prison populations are the invariable deaths in custody that then result.
And speaking of community, I was also curious to get your input on what part conservative or even mainstream media, as well as the Victoria Police, have played in pressuring the Victorian government to introduce these two sets of legislation.
Yeah. What part did they play? They played a significant part, actually. There was significant pressure by mainstream media, which, you know, as an organisation, we felt was, created a moral panic and was blown out of proportion. If you actually look at what the statistics showed, Victoria Police released figures that showed that there were about 300 children committing most of the offences that the community were outraged about. 300 children. Within that group, they said, a core of 20 children were responsible for 20 to 25% of those offences. So target those 20 children in terms of trying to work out why it is that they're offending, and you're going to reduce 20 to 25% of those offences. The creation of this moral panic, we feel, was unwarranted and could have been addressed by a smarter response to youth crime. What was sort of swept under the carpet throughout this whole bail targeting was that in 2024, for example, the Victorian government slashed $1.8 million in funding to YTAS, which is a key youth, you know, it's a key youth support service. Youth crime rates started to spike, and we say that that was a direct result of failure in justice reinvestment. So bail as a mechanism was in fact scapegoated and blamed, when in reality it was really a problem of bad policy by government, bad fiscal policy. What we want to see is an investment by the government into programs that actually address the underlying causes of offending, not investing in more prisons. When you think about the cost, it makes fiscal sense. The cost of keeping a single child in prison for 1 year is $2.84 million. $2.84 million. The cost, that's a single child. Cost of keeping an adult in custody for a year is about $162,000. So this isn't just, this doesn't just make, it makes fiscal sense as well as common sense in actually addressing the underlying causes as to why it is that people are coming into contact with the justice system to begin with. That's what we need to be investing in. You get better bang for your buck that way.
Well, thank you so much, Ali, for providing that much-needed context. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we let you go?
Just to say that, look, we would really like to support. We'd love your support in terms of jumping onto our socials and being loud about, you know, about this being an unfair and wrong proposal. So write to your local government, local member of parliament, and let them know your position, you know, and continue to follow, you know, the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service through the Bail Saves Lives campaign.
And you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. If you're just tuning in, that was an interview with Rob and Ali Bezaroglu of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service speaking about the second set of bail reform that the Victorian government is currently debating in Parliament. Following the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, well, please follow them on Instagram to keep up to date with all their work at Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, and write to your local MP to tell them why this bail reform should not be happening.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you are currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
In a concentration camp. Passport stamped black. Entry denied, lack of medical supplies stacked at the wall where we wait but can't hold back. But don't expect us to wait quietly, persistently, day and nightly. An international movement against the powers that be, the stand between those that are free and those that should be. Never letting complacency cause a vacancy in consciousness. From the river to the sea. From the river to the sea. The river to the sea. Palestine must be free. Run for your life, it's a drone strike. Don't let the empire take your life. Boom, boom. Media distraction, living on rations, no reaction, kill the assassin. Boom. Land invader, perpetrator, genocidal instigator.
living on rations, no reaction, kill the assassin. Boom. Land invader, perpetrator, genocidal instigator. Lead instruction, living on ration, no reaction, taking action. Boom. Empire, rewire, acquire, ceasefire.
That was Ceasefire by Eagle vs. Drone. Next up, we're going to hear from local human rights activist Robert Martin with his speech at yesterday's Free Palestine rally outside the State Library of Victoria, gathering weekly at 12 p.m. every Sunday. He reports back on his recent experience aboard the Handala, one of many vessels part of the ongoing Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Have a listen.
So our first speaker, Robert Martin, has just returned to Australia after being abducted in international waters and deported by Israel, punished for the crime of trying to deliver food and medicine to Gaza aboard Handala with 20 other international activists. Israel's military intercepted the aid vessel illegally, then subjected him to psychological torture, strip searched numerous times, shackled, denied any contact with the outside world. Robert is back with us, and please put your hands together for Robert Martin.
It's been a couple of interesting few months. I've seen a couple of sides of Israel. I've seen the settlers through the occupied West Bank threaten to kill Issa Amro. That was a long time ago when he high-fived the soldiers. I met with a family whose daughter had been intentionally run over by an Israeli settler. The settler still lives there. The family is still has to live without the daughter, but also knowing the family got away with it. A few days ago, I spoke to a family who, you all would have seen this on social media, Palestinian man holding the camera was executed. I spoke to his family, and that particular settler was out, running around very close to them. So I'm not sure what sort of example that gives for Israelis to do the right thing. And as Gideon Levy said, and it just makes so much sense that if you keep giving drug addicts drugs, it's not going to fix the problem. And that's what our government has done, and that's what the American government has done. There's a few things that we need to make clear. A lot of us talk about 600 odd days. It's been 27,900 days since the Nakba. Every Palestinian that has been alive that long has been going through exactly the same stuff that we're going through today. Except people are just starting to see it and wake up and realise. 2018 was Operation Cast Lead. That's when I saw it. I read a book by the Max Blumenthal. It was a book called The 51-Day War. And if you read that book, you knew exactly what was coming. It's exactly the same, except the numbers are bigger. It's the numbers. If you Google some of the Israeli Knesset or political members, you'll have a few that, that will come up and they'll say that I've killed plenty of Arabs, there's nothing wrong with it. We're going to send the Palestinians back to the Stone Age. They're doing this in public. In public. They're not hiding it. These are not gotchas. These are not hidden cameras. This is them saying it, knowing they can get away with it. And then our government and our journalists twist it. We had Donald Trump come out and say that the Palestinians need to change the way they teach about the Israelis. Really? Israel was created on top of Palestine. Israel has no rights, none whatsoever. So I decided to go on a boat and feed the people of Gaza. 21 of us on that boat. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition has been around a long time. A lot of people believe it's new. My boat was the 37th boat attempted to get to Gaza. That's 37. We only heard about the Madeleine because it had Greta on it. And what a wonderful thing that was. Because people now know that we are trying to get to Gaza. I was supposed to be on a boat last year. I got on the boat technically and politically the boat couldn't get out. I was supposed to be on the Conscience. That boat was bombed. Do you know that boat was bombed? In international waters just outside Malta? By Israel? By Israel. International waters, Malta. We want to take food to Gaza. They will bomb boats in international waters. What else are they going to do? We know that there's nothing they won't do. So we're out to sea for 8 days. It's hard, not easy. We had medical supplies, food and teddy bears. That's what we had, because we want to take it to the kids. America and all the other governments want you to believe that Gaza is impossible to get to. That's why all the trucks are blocked up and they have to drop aid in, which kills people. The Mediterranean Sea, that corridor, we open that up, the world changes. Gaza can get fed. Israel doesn't control it. The Freedom Flotilla, they were going to set up one of the boats into a hospital. They can take kids from Gaza to Turkey, to all of these other places. They can turn one of the boats in and just have ambulances go. But again, what? Israel, stop it. Now is the time for us to do more. I know you guys do more, but we need to bring other people into it. There's never been a better time, and I say that not comfortably, because there's never been a better time to be supporting Palestine, but it has come with an unacceptable amount of death. And I'm afraid to say that there's going to be a whole lot more death because the governments are not going to listen enough. I can't believe we're talking about recognition. What are you going to recognise? What about sanctions? What about kicking out every single Israeli ambassador because they should not be in any country at all? How dare they sit in their offices in our country representing a terrorist organisation, one of the most well-funded ever on the planet, with the help of mainstream media. Their time is up. And as you said before, the receipts are here. We have the receipts. They're all on our phones. They're all on our cloud. There won't be a day that you'll be able to get away with this. Years ago, people thought they'd got away with it and it caught up. People will find you. I want to apologise to the people of Gaza that we didn't get the boat there. We tried everything we could. Our boat was, we were kidnapped. We were taken for 11 hours. We were taken to the area of immigration, Ashdod. We were locked up for 4 days. My comrade Tan, who's from Australia, was abused, physically abused, on a daily basis. We have a very powerful tool, which is our passport. They didn't care with her because they beat her up in front of 4 other women. One was a politician from France. They didn't care. But we're all on the right side. We need to take care of each other. And I know when I say, how are you? I know it comes that you're not good, but you're doing what you can. We've got to lean on each other. United, we will beat Israel, but we must stay united. There is another flotilla going at the end of this month. There is 2 organisations. One is the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. The other one is the Samud Coalition, and they are 2 separate, but they are going to be working together. Google it, get involved. There's going to be dozens of boats. It's hopefully going to make a big difference. But we need to do everything we possibly can. And I have one last thing to say. Who thinks that the Freedom Flotilla is a good idea? Yeah. Michael Shaikh, who's a Melbourneian, he came up with the idea, and I think he should take credit, and I love to give him credit because it was such a good idea, but he wanders around and nobody really knows what he does because he does everything under the curtain. That's you, brother. Free Palestine.
And that was human rights activist Robert Martin speaking at yesterday's Free Palestine rally about his most recent expedition with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. For more news, reports and testimonies from the Freedom Flotilla Coalition and its members, you can jump online and head to www.freedomflotilla.org. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM and it's currently 7:44 AM. This is Monday, the 18th of August. Stay with us.
This deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the White Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
Bye.
listening to 3CR on 855 AM. Up next, I'll be speaking with Santosa Mom, who is a third culture kid born and raised in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, of Khmer Chinese heritage. Santosa is frequently known under their artist pseudonym 12x12. Through conceptual representations of her thoughts and memories based on the notion of balancing societal and cultural norms, underlining the challenges and liberation towards their freedom of expression and further exploring their identity. Her recent project dives into the ideas of inherent traumas, defying gender and sex-based expectations within diaspora culture communities, and drawing from their experiences working in the sex industry. Santosa uses photography, retro-futuristic and semi-monochromatic stylized paintings as mediums, with a background in textile design coming from generations of women in the industry. Santosa, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for joining us on the show. So I want to start off by asking you, what was it like growing up in Cambodia?
Growing up in Cambodia was good. I grew up incredibly privileged, having gone to an international school where I guess we're taught at a more globalized scale in comparison to the rest of the nation. But it also created this huge divide, I guess, for me personally, because I could see kids who don't have the luxury of going to school or government's not even regulating all of that, whilst speaking two languages fluently and also not feeling that Cambodian as well, just because I didn't really fit into most people. And I think this is a lot of kids who went to international schools, third culture kids, experienced this sort of identity challenge.
How has that, living the last portion of your life here, how have those stigmas from ideas of what it is to be a child coming from Cambodia challenged you?
It's actually super interesting. I haven't experienced much direct racism because of the way that I speak and the accent that I have and how I can articulate my thoughts in English. But it's always interesting being questioned, like I did in Cambodia as well, why my English sounds like this. Or I would get a lot of condolences on what had happened, you know, in 75, the genocide, the Khmer Rouge. Yeah, challenges. And there's a common misconception about Cambodia, and I think a lot of people lead with that.
Yeah, for sure, as is common with a lot of people from different migrant or
100%.
Refugee backgrounds.
Yeah. 100%. I guess you don't really know a person until you find out, or, yeah, you ask them what it's like you are doing with me now, rather than being like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry about all that happened in your life that I think that I know, but I don't.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I don't know much about Cambodia.
Yeah, it's like at the tippity bottom of like mainland Asia, just before the island. So it's in Southeast Asia, surrounded by Vietnam, Thailand, Laos, and then Myanmar, just on the left. And then just below it, we've got Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, the Philippines, Papua New Guinea, and then Australia, more or less.
So we're pretty much neighbors.
Yeah, kind of. Like, it's only a 13-hour flight away. Only.
Yeah. I'm going to bridge into this now. With Cambodia and Thailand at the moment, the border disputes that are happening there at the moment, could you touch on that, I suppose?
Yeah. I actually didn't really hear about it until I went back to Cambodia recently, a few months ago. And it's really heavy and upsetting to know that the country that I'm from is going through another war, essentially, and more people seeking refuge and more bombs and more deaths and just stress that's affecting not even just Cambodians, but on both sides, in Thailand as well, just in high tension. And I guess me not being there now and being here, I feel as lucky as I feel knowing that I'm more safe, it doesn't make it hurt less knowing that hardships are happening once again to the people.
Yeah, thanks for being open and vulnerable about how it makes you feel, I suppose. Has it brought you together with other people of Cambodian ethnicity or heritage here in Melbourne?
To a degree, yes, but I think with a lot of disputes, I guess, or war, a lot of voices do come up, and sometimes it can be incredibly biased or hateful, and like I grew up with many different types of people, and some of my best friends are from Thailand, and I think that switch and that flip that happens within people, intentionally or not, I think a lot of that, because that exists as well, it's been a pretty difficult conversation to talk about because it gets really heated because everyone is hurting. So I actually haven't spoken about it too much. I think it's more so just checking in if everyone's safe, because we do have family that are quite close by, and checking in with friends as well if their family's safe and how that's doing, rather than, I guess, the more political aspects of it.
Yeah, for sure. Even in your introduction as well, you talked about how, like, you have a background in textile design, and you come from generations of women in the textile industry. And I suppose, has that, coming from a family line where, you know, there is such a strong design element, it's like, has that created familiar expectation? And do you feel that pressure to carry on those traditions?
So I think for the longest time, that pressure did exist. So my grandmother post-war sold fabric at the markets to feed the family, feed her children. And then my mother got into the industry as a... she designed as well. She was a merchant and worked with women as well to empower them and have work and work for themselves. And for the longest time, there was this pressure for me to, you know, take on her business or continue on a sort of legacy. And I wasn't so against the idea of it. I think I was more against the pressure of it. But when I moved to Australia, I ended up, you know, going to uni and specializing in textile design. And as much as I feel as though that was my choice and my passion, growing up around it and just being around fabrics and silks and threads and stuff has influenced it for the good in a positive way. So when, what is it, not societal, sort of family pressures or expectations and intentions come into play, that's never a nice feeling for me. But looking back at it now, I feel incredibly honored and proud, even if the history isn't always super nice with a survival trade. It's nice to be able to share that with my mother and my grandmother.
Yeah, the emphasis on survival trade, I think, is something that, being living in Melbourne and seeing so many people come from privileged places, that are kind of blind or ignorant to the fact that a lot of people here come from war-torn countries or have come here because they've been displaced, and needing to have done something in order to get by is
100%.
It's almost like a distant thing.
Yeah, and it's not even just like, I think it's the mentality of survival as well. I think when you do something or have to do something to survive, may it be to put food on the table or to, like, even to speak. Like, I remember having a conversation with my grandmother because I was curious about her experiences during the Khmer Rouge, and she was whispering, and she wanted to tell me the stories, but she was scared. But even speaking, you were punished for it. You were killed because your information could be, you know, used against you. And that type of way of being gets passed down, and then you start to, because of survival, you're kind of around an environment where even speaking ties with a survival type of, I guess, coping mechanism. And that's just one aspect of it. But yeah, a lot of people have to do a lot of different things because they needed to, and then they continue to do that because that's what they feel as though they need to do.
Yeah, with the goal of liberation, perhaps. You talk about in your work defying gender and sex-based expectations within diaspora culture and communities. But can you comment on that?
This is actually quite recent. So I think gender-based, sex-based... Did you say discrimination?
Yeah, definitely discrimination. Especially in this society we're living in now in Melbourne, Australia, there's so many patriarchal, misogynistic values that are embedded in institutions and systems, and, yeah, having to face that. would be tricky.
Yeah, so I think I kind of touched base on that in the beginning, if I haven't, was like talking about my mom sort of empowering women and women's rights and working and stuff. Australia has a better, I'm going to put that in quotations, platform for equality. But there are still prejudice and sexism, even if it's not within jobs, it's within a sort of cultural, societal context, may it be through intimacy or vulnerability.
To bridge into Vixen, Vixen workers, for those listeners who aren't aware, racist raids are happening against Asian migrant sex workers and have been increasing over the last few months across Victoria and the country. And I think there's a movement to stop the raids and that sort of thing and demand an end to violent actions that leave migrant sex workers in the firing line of a lot of that.
I think I understand what you're trying to say. It's like not necessarily like a survival type of progression. And I'm not saying that Asian sex workers come from a survival mentality, but I'm also not saying that they don't. And with discrimination within the sex industry, specifically towards Asian workers, it's that kind of ties to the discrimination that I was trying to talk about before within intimacy. There's this stigma or fetishization of Asian women, may it be that they're more submissive or easier to be a certain way because of the cultural conditionings that, you know, they've had to come from, or even people being sex tourists going to these places. And these raids that are happening, it just continues to create an environment where people don't feel safe. And even migrating to a different country, may it be for a better opportunity or may it be for the trust in that safety exists, it's incredibly disappointing to continue to see the discrimination that you feel as though no longer exists. And it's maybe even more so because then you could lose your visa, you could lose your rights to be in the country, and then you get deported, and then you have to go back to the place that you've worked so hard to not be in anymore. And those traumas really, really impact you as a person, like in its entirety, and not even just your ability to work or your ability to express yourself or your ability to, you know, so many different things. It destroys a person.
Have you experienced sexism here in Australia?
This is an interesting one because when I think about it, it's like, no. But there's so many different things that have happened from working in the sex industry that I've sort of allowed myself to believe is the truth of the reality, being an Asian woman. Like, the submissive bit or the fetishization of Asian women. And when I was working, it definitely was a key selling point, in quotations, because of, I don't know if it's accessibility, like if there's not enough Asian women around, but it creates this demand for it. And yeah, like my identity revolved around that because that's what I thought that I was supposed to be. Because it worked, because I made money, or I was able to sustain, I was able to create some form of security or safety within myself because it was attractive to people. But then within that comes all the other stuff, like, oh, you're supposed to be like this, or I thought Asian women were like this, this, and this. And the stigma becomes the identity because that's what you're continuously told, but it's not. But then you have to battle it within, not even just yourself, but within the people that follow those ideas.
Sentosa, I've only got time for one more question.
Sure.
But how can we as a community better support those who have experienced racism or sexism or discrimination of any sort here in Australia and locally in Melbourne or Nam?
I think it's really important to approach everyone with curiosity. Different people need different types of support, and it's, yeah, everybody's different. People want to support themselves in a certain way, and people want to support from other people in certain ways. In saying that, there's a project that I'm currently working on that touches base on diaspora traumas, sexual traumas, PTSD, generational challenges. That's coming up on Thursday, the 21st of August, 6 to 8 at Galleria Crocodillo. in Preston, 738 Plenty Road. And it's with a group of artists curated by Clemens Soss. And the theme is called Witches. And this, like, that is the example of what support looks like within the community. It's a bunch of people, a bunch of women getting together and supporting each other in our crafts. And just making this space for us to be without any expectations or any preconceived notions of having to show up a certain way. You just show up as you in whatever shape or form. Yeah, that's what it looks like to support the community and to support your fellow friends or lovers.
For those listening who are interested, I'll drop a link in the show notes under Monday Breakfast. Power to Sentosa. That's all we've got time for.
Thank you, Edmi.
Thank you for coming on the show, and I hope you have a beautiful day.
Okay, bye.
Do you work in a brothel, massage shop, escort agency, fetish house or dungeon, cam studio or porn set, sauna, short-time hotel, outdoors or on the street, or in any other space where sex work happens? Recent changes to Victorian sex work laws mean that sex workers now have more options for how and where we can work and who we can work with.
To find out more about Victoria's new sex work laws, contact Vixen, Victoria's statewide peer-only sex work organisation, 100% by and for all sex workers on 039-070-9050.
And talk to another sex worker about what the partial decriminalisation of sex work means for you, your workplace and your community. Or check out the Decrim Info Hub at vixen.org.au. Vixen is a 3CR supporter.
Just common sense. So use your words. I'm gonna converse. Can't let down my walls. When you're putting up more, just sitting on defense. And you'd rather pretend that it's not your fault. But you love to benefit. Yeah, that's the illusion. You're part of the show. Black and mirrors. And you don't smell.
Common sense.
this deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the white Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. If you're just tuning in, before that CSA, we heard Common Sense by Yara, who's a local Melbourne artist. Up next, we'll be continuing on the topic of the conflicts happening between Cambodia and Thailand and the reasons behind them, including the truce and the sensitivity of the truce, as well as the displacement of around 270,000 people. We'll hear from a segment from 3CR's Tuesday Home Time from last week, where 3CR's Jan Bartlett interviewed Emeritus Professor Damien Kingsbury.
Cambodia will nominate US President Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, its Deputy Prime Minister said, following his direct intervention in halting the Southeast Asian country's recent border conflict with Thailand. But I think we have to look beyond Mr. Trump for the answer to the recent flare-up in conflict between the two neighbours in Southeast Asia. And to do that, I spoke with Damien Kingsbury, former journalist and academic, retired from Deakin University at the end of 2020 when he was made Emeritus Professor in July 2021. Damien, the recent fighting between Thailand and Cambodia is just the latest in a long-standing disagreement between the two countries. How far back in history do we need to go for the reason or reasons or perhaps the blame for the continuing tensions which erupt into conflict?
Well, there's three elements to the conflict, the first of which goes back to colonial history, the French carving out a border with Thailand and not demarcating the border properly. So in 1907, the French and the then Thai government decided that there would be a watershed agreement, that is, that the border would follow a watershed to the Mekong. But that was always a bit ambiguous, and the two sides have disputed the extent of the borders since, particularly during the Second World War. The International Court of Justice has made a ruling on the border twice, and it has determined that the ancient temple complexes in the border region are within Cambodian territory, but access to them is via Thailand. The Thai government, or the Thai military in particular, has never been particularly keen on accepting this ruling. So that's one level of the conflict. The other level is that the Thai military has used the conflict or tensions around the border to embarrass its own former political leader and former prime minister who's now been deposed. That's the second part. And the third part is that there are illegal internet or phone scam operations operating in the border region which are controlled by the Thai military, and they can fall on either side of the border. So access to these scam centres and control over them is also a point of dissent between the two countries.
Let's go back to number one to do with the temples. Who's at fault?
Well, it's not really a case of who's at fault. It's more a case of where the border is understood to exist.
So this is France?
Well, yeah, I mean, colonial powers always have a lot to answer for in the final analysis. But there has been a dispute over where the Thai and Cambodia borders exist, and they have moved since 1907. In particular, during the Second World War, when what was then Indochina, French colonial Indochina, was occupied by Imperial Japan, the border was extended. Now, Thailand, in the early part of the war, was an ally of Japan, so the border was actually shifted back into Cambodia, so parts of what are now Cambodia were actually demarcated as Thai territory. At the end of the war, the border was pushed back to something approximating its earlier position. So, but the borders are not fixed. These are, in a sense, arbitrary borders. They are lines drawn on maps which don't necessarily correspond to where people of particular national groups might live or who historically had control over those regions.
And there's no way within Cambodia for people to get access to the temples without going through Thailand?
The main temple, Prea Vihar, sits on an escarpment or a cliff face. The view that it has is magnificent. So the view from Prea Vihar looks over Cambodia, and the temple itself technically sits within Cambodian territory, but the back of the escarpment flows back into Thai territory, into Thai country, and that's where the border dispute has blown up on a number of occasions. The question is whether there should be access allowed to the temple via the Thai-controlled territory, or whether some of the territory should be ceded to Cambodia, because it's not possible to get to it via the cliff face. Of course, this goes back to the ancient Khmer Empire of the 8th and 9th century, when this temple was built. Of course, the Khmer Empire extended well into what is now Thailand, so that wasn't an issue. But since the demarcation of the border along the watershed to the Mekong, it has made access much more difficult.
Is anyone working, or people's working, on how to resolve this issue between the two countries on this particular point?
Not really, no. Thailand has refused international mediation on the issue. And I think this reflects the assertiveness of the Thai military, which really does run policy around border issues. They don't want external interference because they know that if there is external involvement, there will be a determination made, as indeed there has been already twice by the International Court of Justice, which will ultimately find in favour of Cambodia, and they don't want to cede that point. So whilst Cambodia is happy to have international mediation on the issue, Thailand is not, and Thailand doesn't recognise the ICJ ruling, and it also doesn't recognise any further international involvement in this particular issue.
Well, number two involves the military. Does it also involve the two main families in Cambodia and Thailand?
Yeah, look, Thaksin Shinawat was Prime Minister of Thailand many years ago now. He essentially was the leader of a populist movement, a very wealthy man in his own right, a billionaire, but led a populist movement in Thailand, which was, if you like, counterposed to the elite control of the country, which corresponded to the king, the royal family, and the Thai military support for both the royal family and for the elite political and economic structures. So Thaksin came up and was elected as prime minister, and the military said, well, we're losing control of the situation. So they staged a coup and got rid of him. But his party has transformed over the years, and it's under a number of different guises and continues to receive popular support. It's also received popular support initially under the leadership of his sister, and then more recently that of his daughter. And the Thai military basically sees this as Thaksin by any other means. So they have pushed both his Thaksin sister out of power in a coup, and more recently have pushed out his daughter in a judicial process that was allegedly around ethics, which is unusual in a place like Thailand, because his daughter had conversations with Cambodia's former Prime Minister, Hun Sen, about the border issue in seeking to resolve it. And in the conversation she had, she referred to him as uncle, and she said that the Thai military had behaved very badly. Thai military said that that was a breach of ethics and loyalty to their own country, and she has since been judicially deposed.
Well, this is just one of many coups, surely, in Thailand.
Yes, Thailand has a very long history of coups, going back to the late 1920s, the 1930s, and it has had a history of military involvement in government, indeed, up until the 1950s and 60s, and then into the 70s. Thailand had military governments, and it has had, on many occasions, the military taking over and running the place, including up to this century, up until the last 10 or 15 years. We have the Thai military that sees itself as having an inbuilt role in Thai politics. It sees its role as preserving the status quo, as it determines the status quo. The status quo is built, as I mentioned, around the royal family and the position of the king. And around that is built an economic elite. And the Thai military is deeply embedded with this economic elite itself. It has many of its own business interests, which are quite substantial and which reward its senior officers. So it sees its role as preserving this version of the status quo against what appears to be a push by a more populist party, arguably a more left-wing party, but certainly a more populist party, which is based in the regions, amongst the rural population.
Well, into the scene comes the Hun Sen family.
Yes, so we have Hun Sen, who has stepped down as Prime Minister of Cambodia. His son, Hun Manet, is now Prime Minister, but Hun Sen is still in the power behind the throne. He's the Speaker of the Cambodian Parliament, but he really continues to wield a great deal of influence. So if he has a conversation with the Prime Minister of Thailand, that is understood to be effectively as important as having a conversation between two prime ministers, even though Hun Sen is no longer Prime Minister of Cambodia. So this conversation that was had with Hun Sen was recorded. It was leaked. In the recording, it does have the now ousted Prime Minister of Thailand talking, referring to Hun Sen as uncle. Now, that reflects the Thaksin Shinawatra's close relationship with Hun Sen. Thaksin himself actually lived in Cambodia for some time. He was given protection there. Cambodia refused to extradite him to Thailand. And when Thaksin eventually went back to Thailand a couple of years ago, went back to jail very briefly. The king said, okay, look, you know, we'll pardon you, let you out. Hun Sen came to visit him immediately on his release from prison. So the relationship between Thaksin and Hun Sen is quite close. Having said that, Thaksin recognises that the Thai military does have the whip hand in this issue, and he has decided that perhaps his friendship with Hun Sen is not worth angering the Thai military any further. So he has actually now supported the Thai military in this more recent conflict over the border region.
Apart from all this, is there another elephant in the room or not?
There is believed to be, and I don't have hard evidence of this, but I have reports of this from people I know who know the area quite well and whose judgment I trust. And they say that there's a number of scam telephone operation centres in the border region. That stands to reason because we know they exist on the Thai border with Myanmar, and that's been well documented. So the fact that they would also exist on the Cambodian border wouldn't be at all surprising. These are basically operations which are great money-making centres. They're staffed by people from Cambodia primarily, who are effectively slaves and kept as prisoners by the Thai military to operate these centres. And this is a great money-making scam for the Thai military. But the problem is, of course, it operates on the border, which is under dispute, and the Thai military is keen to be able to ensure these operations continue without having to be susceptible to Cambodian control or interference.
Is it an intractable dispute? Because you've got a much larger country in Thailand, you've got a much poorer, smaller country, Cambodia.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. I think that the fact that Thailand is refusing to have international mediation is probably the biggest issue here. And look, neither side really wants to have a war. They both know that the costs of war exceed the benefits. But there is, from time to time, a dust-up around the border region about who controls what, about access to these call centres, about national pride, which runs very strong in both countries, and, of course, in the case of Thailand in particular, about ensuring that the issue can be used to embarrass the Tuxman family when it's in power to show that it doesn't really have control of what's going on in its regional relations.
Are there any influences from outside?
The United States and China both have an interest in the area. China has been fairly hands-off to date, but Cambodia is effectively a Chinese client state. The United States has also stepped in this recent round of fighting and said to both countries, look, you know, you need to settle this down, otherwise we're going to slap you both with tariffs. That corresponded to an end in the fighting, but I'm not sure that it actually was the cause of the end of the fighting, even though Donald Trump is claiming it to be a victory of his. I think that both sides are basically, this got out of hand. Thailand wanted to create an embarrassment for the Thaksin family. They did that once the Thaksin's daughter was removed from office. This continued on. So the Thai military said, we've achieved our objective with this. We don't actually want this to continue any further. There's no benefit in it. So I think they were quite happy to stop the fighting. And Cambodia, militarily, even though it's been recently rearmed by China, doesn't have the capacity to take on a much bigger and much more powerful country such as Thailand.
Just finally, Damien, while the parties in these conflicts are playing war games with each other, it's the populations in the border areas who are paying the price.
Yes, and as always in wars, it's you know, there are generals which will pursue particular goals, but it's civilians who ultimately pay the greatest price. It's always a disproportionate death toll between military people and civilians, and certainly that was the case in relation to this recent blow-up between Thailand and Cambodia. We don't know precisely how many people have been killed, but it's about 40 or 50 on each side. And that's not obviously on the scale of somewhere like Gaza at the moment, but it is a problem for the people whose lives are there. You know, civilian infrastructure was targeted. The lives have been disrupted. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. And, of course, it always does have the scope for getting out of control. And that's a problem with these sorts of conflicts, is if they can be contained, all well and good, that's a great thing. But sometimes they're not contained, and despite the best efforts of governments, the shooting continues and it ultimately escalates into a full-blown war. And we have seen in the past the consequences of that in Southeast Asia, where tens and indeed hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives.
Well, as you said, there's three issues and none of these have been resolved. So there is a possibility that this conflict will continue into the future.
Yeah, it's probable that there will be continual flare-ups. But I think whilst the issue is one of external control about interests such as control of scam centres, using the issue to embarrass certain political figures in either country and so on, that it will be contained. Neither country wants to see this get out of control. Having said that, there is always the possibility that events could escape the control of the people who are basically deciding the fates of the people who live in the border, and it could blow up into a full-scale war between the two countries, or indeed involving other countries.
Welcome to the Seaward District 3066.
Join us for a concert, speeches and food at Collingwood Yards to raise awareness for International Overdose Day. Come together as a community, pay our respects for those that have passed and survivors, friends and families. Performances by Resonant Frequency, catering by Food Not Bombs, supported by Inner Space Crew and CoHealth on the 29th of August, 2 to 4pm. Resonant Frequency are a 3CR supporter.
You are a shadow, transparent, a memory once human. You pass through me.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You've been listening to the Monday Breakfast Show with me, Hannah, and Edmi. At the beginning of the show, we heard an interview that Rob did with Ali Bezaroglu, the Director of Legal Service from the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Services, about the proposed bail law amendments in Victoria. And then after that, we heard human rights activist Robert Martin from yesterday's Free Palestine rally and his recent experience on the Freedom Flotilla.
After that, we heard from Sentosa Mom, a Cambodian migrant artist living in Australia, about her experience working in the sex industry, her artistic expression and Cambodian heritage. And lastly, we just heard from a segment from 3CR's Tuesday Hometime last week, where 3CR's Jan Bartlett interviewed Emeritus Professor Damien Kingsbury about the ongoing conflict between Cambodia and Thailand.
Also, some community events you guys should attend this week. The Boycott Caltex National Day of Action is happening this Saturday on the 23rd of August. There are a few around Victoria and interstate. To find your local event, go to boycottcaltex.com. I meant .org, sorry. And Overdose Awareness Day is on the 29th. There'll be a concert organised by Maurice from the Resident Frequency Show that happens on Thursdays from 12 to 1pm. The concert is on the 29th from 2 to 4pm at the Collingwood Yards.
Love you.
Love y'all.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.